everyone, and welcome to the Gravel Junction podcast, your meeting place for all things bikes, adventures, and the stories that follow. I'm your host, Charles Detmer. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Gravel Junction podcast. As always, it is a pleasure to have you. On today's show, Mr. Dave Rome. Now, I'm sure many of you listening will know who Dave is, will recognize his voice. If you don't know who Dave is, as I say, as soon as you hear his voice, you'll be like, ah, I know that guy. Dave, previously from a very well-known cycling podcast and website, although no longer, I'll get into that in a moment. I reached out to Dave to see if he'd want to come on the show and, you know, give us some tips and tricks for those of you, those of us, who like to get their hands a bit dirty with their bike. You know, not scared to grease a bearing, to change, you know, swap out a crank, clean a crank, those sort of things. Get a little bit deeper. And maybe you would like to know some tools, tips, tricks to get you on that path. Or maybe you're already on that path and you just like some other information. And who better than Dave Rome to give us this information, known for his tome-like articles on things such as waxing chains and torque wrenches. Dave was the perfect person to come on the show and cover this topic. As I said at the top there, Dave previously with another website, now along with the wonderful Mr. Kaylee Fretz and a couple other colleagues, have started a new show. You may or may not have seen it, called Placeholders. I think they're up to episode 4 or 5 by now. And very quickly have gone straight back or jumped straight back into the rhythm of it, if not a better rhythm, because I think they're going to have free rein to do whatever they like to give the people what they want. So I'm excited to see where that show goes. Excited to see the freedom Dave's going to be to talk about all things nerdy, geeky, mechanic, tools. It's going to be wonderful. And we touch on a bit of that in today's show. So without further ado, let's get straight into it. Here's my conversation with Dave Rome. Enjoy. So it gives me great pleasure today to introduce our guest, a preeminent force in the world of bike mechanics and tools. Some have said royalty, the Prince Harry to James Wong's Prince William. Joining us today from the Emerald City, the Harbour City in Sydney, welcome to the show, Mr. Dave Rome. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
I appreciate the time difference, although I'm pretty sure with your past, you're used to jumping on a podcast at various times of the day or evening. What time is it there by you now?
It's not bad at all. It's 5 p.m. So we're quite in the clear for it still being a good hour. So
in the past, podcasting with the US, like what time would you normally have to get on?
It depends who's on the other end, right. Really. Yeah. So the struggle is when you're trying to do a podcast with Europe and America on the same podcast, and then one of you has to pull the short straw, and it's normally the Aussie that does that. So
down at the bottom there, you guys get up late. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So then the hours can be pretty bad. I think the worst I've ever done is like 4 a.m.
Oh,
which is a pretty bad time to have to try be entertaining.
Yeah, for. That's sense of humor failure around that time for me, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I kind of wanted to, like, it goes without saying, a lot of people listening to this show would know who you are, what you do. But I'd like a bit of your background as to how you've become or got to this point. Dave Rome, the tool guy, mechanic guy, and I'm definitely abbreviating there. What is your path, journalism, etc., to where have you come from?
I was born in a hardware store, and bikes has sort of been fundamental to my life, I guess, and at least from early days of a nerdy teenager. So I got into mountain biking when I was 13-ish. My father was into it, but I ignored that until a friend of mine got me into it. And then I kind of just the bug bit pretty hard from there. I think, you know, within the first year, I was mowing every lawn I could find just to buy bike parts, and started fixing my own stuff because that was the cheapest way to do it. And became a shop rat by the time I was about 16, and, you know, full time in a bike shop straight, you know, first day after my exams in the end of high school, I was full time in a bike shop, and it sort of just continued on from there. I've always been, yeah, full time in the industry since then.
Right. Okay. I didn't know. So you've always had this sort of mentality of loving, not scared to take things apart, put them back together, wanting to know how they work. Has that kind of been a big driving force behind it?
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's just the idea of tinkering and kind of the idea of, yeah, as you say, like figuring out how it works. And to know that, to do that, you have to kind of pull it apart. And the early days, I'd get the pulling it apart bit of it right, and not so much to get it back together again. And
especially with suspension and things like that, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, that's the best way to start, is by breaking things. But yeah, from there, you know, like over time, I guess the skills started to match the enthusiasm, and I don't end up with so many useless parts these days as I once did.
You know, progress is good. Progress is good.
Yeah.
And then how did you end up sort of in the media world, or the journalist? Is that the world? Is that the right word?
Yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting one. Like a lot of that, it's, as you probably know, like the cycling world is, it's a big industry, but a small world. And I knew the right people that also were on similar paths, and they sort of brought me into what they were doing. So I was racing cross country mountain bike at the time, and some friends of mine, one of them who runs Flow Mountain Bike magazine out of Australia, Mick Ross, he was actually the store manager at my local bike shop, so I used to annoy him all the time. And he became the co-editor of Australian Mountain Bike magazine. That was his first job in media. And he knew me as the dorky kid that wore Lycra and rode mountain bikes, and everyone else in his circle didn't wear Lycra. So he wanted me on board for cross country testing. And it happened pretty organically like that. But it took quite a few years. I remember my first invite to a magazine bike test, I had to turned down because I was racing at the time. And then a year later, I was working in brand management and wholesale, and at that point it was a conflict of interest. So it took about 3 or 4 years of invites before I could finally say yes. And it was kind of fell into it. It was very much like a thing I did for cash and a bit for fun while I was at university, and finished university, and I kind of just kept going at it.
Yeah. No, I can imagine. Like, that, these are, I say old school, tongue in cheek, right? This is still print media, as in going, writing the articles, sort of pre-internet, you know, should we say cycling websites, podcasts, etc. And did that organically happen when the cycling media as we know it today, did that happen quite quickly, or that change from print to what it is today? I mean, that's quite a big question.
I mean, when I first got into cycling media, I mean, Pink Bike was a thing, a big thing at that point. You know, MTBR forums are very much a thing. Weight Weenies was a thing. So the internet was still buzzing. I'd say the magazines were still the strong media. But yeah, for me, the transition happened pretty quickly because I was there from the beginning with Flow Mountain Bike, that mountain bike site, which is still going today. And they started as a digital born with a print mag, and they quickly got rid of the print mag. So for me, I was writing on the internet pretty early as far as my writing career goes.
So it was a good time really when you joined.
Yeah. So I did a few years of just purely print based stuff, and then after that I was onto the web. But yeah, I mean, I'm young enough that the internet's been a part of my life, around for at least most of my life. So yeah, and then Bike Radar happened. That was my first full time gig in media. So I was Australian editor of that, and they ended up without editor in chief for a year or two while I was there, and that was sort of a shared role amongst the other editors. So journalism. recovering from a bit of a cold. But
is that what you studied?
Yeah, so I didn't study journalism. No, it wasn't my desired path in life. I actually did like a business commerce with majors in marketing and international business, and I had plans of pursuing. I'd done a bit of brand management at a national level, and I'd sort of planned to go into the industry that way and look after some brands and sort of steer product design that way. Before that, I was initially enrolled in industrial design with university, but I never quite pursued that that path because I kept meeting unemployed industrial designers. So
okay. I'm seeing a trend. I'm walking away.
Yeah, exactly. So the design stuff was very interesting to me, but I ended up thinking marketing was my way to stay in the industry at a high level.
Mm. But I imagine that degree, even though you've ended up more in the sort of media journalistic side, those sort of insights and that knowledge would stand you in good stead when it comes to dealing with brands and the communication side of things, I imagine.
Yeah, it does. It's definitely useful. I'd say it's most handy when you can kind of see the reasoning behind why brands do certain things, like the way they price things or their product ranges and the way they move different products around in the range or the way they make room for new products. And that was always really interesting to me when I was studying it. And for me, that's, I guess these days I've got pretty good insight into seeing why brands do the things that they do.
I think that's as a listener, listening to you on a number of shows over the years, like that's always been something that's really stuck out for me, is where your points of view, you have that sort of, that view, point of view, which you're like, oh, I hadn't thought about it that way. And you connect the dots so well, which makes, that's what, so that crystal ball effect that you seem to have sometimes. But having been on the inside for a while, having studied that, I suppose it allows you to speak that sort of language or read that language between the lines a little bit.
Yeah, I think so. Either that or I'm just full of crap, but hopefully
Look,
generally it's, right. It's, I don't know.
10%, 9%, 90% what you, how you say it, right? So that's all, that's all that counts. Exactly. But all right, so I wanted to, I did have a topic I wanted to kind of touch on here and to tap into your expertise, because as everyone knows, we were just talking before hitting record here that we're waiting for the day that the Dave Rome tool meme hits TikTok and Instagram. Because it's coming. And today I wanted to kind of touch a lot of the listeners of this show, I think, being quite a niche show, the Gravel Junction, I know a lot of them personally, are quite mechanically able. And I'd like to sort of discuss a bit of a, I don't know if beginner's kit's the right way, but if we wanted to strip down our own bike at home, what would be your kind of essential kit? Because I do understand asking you about tools is kind of like asking Neo to take the red pill. How far does the rabbit hole go? I do understand.
I don't even know how far the rabbit hole goes.
Exactly. So, you would have taken both pills. So it's sort of like, I want to be able to strip my bike, put a headset, BB, what stands, things like that, that you'd recommend, expensive, not expensive, good value. What would be like your starting point there?
My starting point is generally to, I guess, firstly, like figuring out how much you want to do on the bike. Because if you're not interested in doing anything complex like building a bike, then you obviously don't need to be investing in a lot of tools. But I'd say for pretty much everyone, even if you're just lubing your chain, then like a work stand really should be the foundation of a workshop. It just makes such a huge difference, and it really does open up the repairs that you can do comfortably without scratching everything without damaging more things than you need to. So a solid work stand is...
To interrupt on that one, you see guys putting their bikes upside down to work on things. I've heard that is a no-no. Could you explain if that is or isn't, and if it is, why it is not a good thing to do?
For me, it's a no-no because I'm so used to doing things in a work stand that I have to think about everything backwards when it's upside down. So I actually look like I've never worked on a bike before when the bike's upside down. But the main thing is that the bike's not very stable when it's upside down, and you've also don't have full access to everything. So you can't adjust a headset while it's upside down. You can't easily remove a stem. You can't adjust anything on the seat or seat post.
So like hydraulic brakes, you're not going to, if you want to, let's say, adjust your brakes, because I've done that before. I've got a rubbing brake, loosen the caliper, putting it upside down to do that, you're not going to have air bubbles. That's what someone's mentioned to me. And I was like, oh, I hadn't really thought about that. Could that be an issue?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. So if you've got any air in your brake system previously and it wasn't bled correctly to begin with, then turning your bike upside down will make that air pocket travel to the opposite side of the brake, where it will then squish under the brake compression. So your brakes will then go soft or even pull to the handlebar, because that air has now found itself to the caliper where it can compress. So that's the issue there. So, and a lot of brakes aren't bled correctly for whatever reason. So it is kind of likely that if you turn your bike upside down for an extended period of time, that little bit of air will find its way where you don't want it. So that's the theory there that most people want to avoid. But if the brake is bled correctly to begin with, then you can turn it upside down and that won't be a factor. But yeah, like, you can't bleed a brake while the bike's upside down, because most brakes, you know, you need access to the lever. There's other things, like you'll probably end up scratching your nice, especially on a gravel bike, you'll scratch your nice levers. If the bike's upside down, you might scratch your saddle. There's a lot of functional reasons, but fundamentally it's a stability thing, and it's also just an ease of access thing. So a work stand puts it at a comfortable height where you're not hunched over, and it holds the bike where you can undo tight things and do delicate things without having to worry about the bike toppling over.
As a work stand, what would be sort of, if you had to give sort of an entry point and your dream work stand, which would be?
Yeah, so there's a few categories of work stand. Like the questions I'd be asking if someone was looking to buy a work stand is, do you want it to be portable? Like, do you need it to be able to fold up to take it to an event or take it on holiday or wherever you're going? Or do you want it like as a permanent thing in your workshop that doesn't move? And those are two very different products. Generally speaking, I'd say for work stands, look for one that clamps the bike via the C-post. You'll get the other star, which sort of cradles the bike from underneath via the bottom bracket. And I'd actually typically say avoid those, because anyone listening to this podcast is probably on a bike with disc brakes these days. And those work stands that cradle the bike, you need to take one wheel off to mount the bike in the work stand. So you're forever going to be adjusting one of your brakes out of a work stand with, you know, everything falling over on top of you. So a work stand that actually clamps onto the seat post is going to be the way to go. In terms of cheap ones, I think you mentioned before we started recording, you've had a bit of experience with the Aldi maybe, or
yeah, whatever. Yeah. It was through Wiggle in the UK, £90, you know, folded legs, not the most stable, but for £90, it really did the job.
Yep. So that's a pretty generic stand. So like Wiggle sell them, and Bike24 have their own brand of one. And I think Aldi have one every quarter that's even cheaper, but basically the same manufacturer. And it's not bad. They actually work pretty well and they last pretty well. So if you're on an absolute budget, it is an option. But you sort of, those work stands, what they lack is you're not able to very quickly adjust the angle of the bike. You kind of have to partly undo the stand and move it into a notch setting with those cheaper stands. So it means when you're bleeding a disc brake, a hydraulic disc brake, you actually want to be able to move the angle of the bike to like in a finite way. And those work stands sort of inhibit you doing that. And they're also just not very stable if you're using them on uneven ground. So my advice is typically to spend more. And I'm a big fan of like Feedback Sports for their work stands, just because they seem to be they seem to last a lifetime, and Park Tool is the other obvious one. But yeah, my first ever work stand, I started with something pretty fancy. I think I was 14 or 15, and it was a birthday present. I pulled all my money together and I got a Feedback Sports. Back then it was actually under a different name. It was Ultimate, and I got their pro version. I think it cost like $350-$400 Australian at the time. I actually still have that work stand, and I haven't replaced a single part on it yet. And all these years later, I think that's 18 years ago now, I can still get parts for that work stand. So if something does break, then I can repair that thing. So that speaks pretty highly for a product that you don't have too many consumer products out there that 20 years of use and you can still keep the thing going like it's new.
That's often the case I've found with those foundational tools like your work bench, your yeah. the that spending more money on those sort of things, you know, that's where you get your real value.
Yes.
In that they just last and last and last. And then the smaller finicky things can be a little bit more throwaway, if that's the right way. Absolutely. But like you say, spending money on a good stand, it'll stand you in good stead.
Yes. Yep. Absolutely. So yeah, and that's the thing.
It was sitting there. I had to take it.
Well learned. Yeah, that's the thing with those, like, the, as you say, foundation tools, is the work stand, like those things that you, I'm going to assume that anyone listening to this considers themselves like a lifelong cyclist. It's not a quick little hobby fad for them that they're going to give up in the next year. So in that sense, if you imagine that you're going to be lubing your chain for the next 20 years, or whatever you need to do to a bicycle, it's worth spending more now because you just won't have to buy the thing again. It'll really serve you. So yeah, other tools in that category, like, you know, just spend decent money on a good set of hex keys, because that's something you're going to use every single time you fix a bike. You know, your general tools is where I'd spend money on. So get, you know, good pliers, good screwdriver, good hex keys. And you know, that's just simply because that stuff lasts better, but also the more you spend, the more precise it fits.
I found that with like the 6mm hex key on my through axle, I've got a couple different sets, and it's amazing how much play there is between the hex keys and the quality, and it very easily strip the bolt if you're not careful.
Yeah. Yeah. A cheap set of hex keys can actually cause a lot of expensive damage. So, yeah, certainly the tolerances, as you go up in price, the fit of the hex keys tend to be tighter, just because those companies are able to hold tighter tolerances without overshooting that tolerance, without making them too big.
What brand would you say? Is it Wera? Vera? I mean, I've
yeah, Wera is really good. I've actually got their advent calendar next to me, which is...
I did see some of that on the socials.
Yeah, that's a bit of unnecessary consumerism right there. But yeah, Wera is good. I actually prefer... There's a Swiss company, PB Swiss, which are like a 100-year-old Swiss manufacturing business that
we've made is hex keys for 100 years. We're really good.
Pretty much, yeah. It's like hex keys and screwdrivers is kind of all they do, and they do tools for like medical instruments, and so they really have impressive stuff. Their real attribute is the steel that they use is sort of well regarded to be sort of the most durable steel in the world. So the hex keys outlast everything else, but that's my go-to. But they're quite expensive. Wera is a price point down from there, and the other one that I'm quite fond of is Weha, which is another German company. They're a direct competitor to Wera. Of really good quality, and you can get them, you know, if you look online, you can often find them for not crazy prices. And those will serve you really well. If anyone's listening in the US, then there's brands like Bondus, which is sort of quick search on Amazon will bring up far too many options. And that's American made stuff. That's also really good.
Would you? So, okay. So the work stand. So from my personal experience, I bought, I was traveling and I wanted a kit. Is it Pro Tools, Pro Cycling, Shimano? I always think like, what is their full name? Shimano? Is it just Pro?
Pro Bike Gear, which is... I actually don't understand this, but there's another company called Pro Components or something, which is a completely separate company that's using the same trademark. And for some reason, Shimano didn't shut it down. And now they're huge. They've got like 60 employees. And they both do the same torque wrench. They both offer the same torque wrench. It's really funny. But they're completely separate companies.
I'm surprised. As you say, I'm surprised Shimano didn't clamp that down straight away. But... so I bought one of their kits, like middle range kit that has, you know, you can change a bottom bracket, a threaded bottom bracket, chain whip tool, etc. And pretty much has everything you could do except a press fit bottom bracket and a headset. Are those sort of kits decent value? And then maybe buy one or two other specialized tools for sensitive areas such as BB, headset, etc.?
My advice is generally, like, if you've got a huge amount of bikes, like a really varied number of bikes, like you've got your road bike, your gravel bike, your mountain bike, you might have maybe some kids' bikes in the garage, and you don't know what you're going to be working on, then those kits are really good because they give you a lot of tools for not a lot of money. But if you've only got one or two bikes, my advice would probably be to start from scratch and buy just what you need, but buy slightly better quality. So, you know, really piece it together. And then that way you'll end up with better tools and you won't end up paying for something that you're never going to use. Like not everyone needs a set of cone wrenches or whatever else is in those kits that isn't so popular anymore.
Yeah, there are a few things I still don't know what they are. I lost the instructions. I'm like, I've never used that. I don't know what it does. So see, it's kind of like I should probably research. That's probably a very useful tool. So bottom brackets, that's something that intimidates me, and headsets. Is that something you should be taking to your shop? Okay, so my gravel bike's got threaded, T47, big fan of my Creekendale has BB, you know, 30... I've lost track of the names. Just actually had that in the shop now to remove a creak. Would you recommend, depending on your BB, whether you work on it yourself?
Yeah, I think that's good advice generally, because a threaded system with any crank these days is going to be pretty, generally speaking, is going to be pretty user serviceable. So like a threaded bottom bracket, most of them will just need one tool to take that bottom bracket out and maybe like a large ratchet to drive that one socket. Sorry. Still recovering. it really wiped me out. But a large ratchet to drive that socket. And the struggle is that there's a lot of these new designs on the market. So your T47 is, depending on which bottom bracket you have, that might require a completely different tool. And then some of the latest designs are actually pretty fussy with how the tools engage. So you kind of, in some cases,
not much tolerance.
There's you know, maybe a millimeter or a millimeter and a half of tool fitment with some of these internal bearing T47 designs. And they, to not strip the whole bottom bracket, you kind of are starting to need some pretty sophisticated tools to work with them.
So what I'm kind of, for my spot, is that a case of, okay, remove the cranks, you can clean, service things, but actually removing bottom brackets, unless you really know what you're doing, you can still go pretty deep, as I say, removing cranks, like we spoke about before, remove the jockey wheels, re-grease them, it's not that scary, but when it comes to actually removing the BB, that may be something for the pros, just as things are getting more and more technical.
Yeah, it's certainly like you used to be able to pull any bottom bracket with the same tool, and that used to be really easy, whereas now it seems like every single bike on the market requires a different tool to the next. And that makes it pretty expensive if you're constantly changing your bikes or you've got multiple bikes. So it's safe to remove the crank, and then from there you can actually get pretty good access to the bearings to clean them out. I'd say if you're having to pull the bottom bracket, then it's probably going to be a question of what exactly is in that frame and whether it's worth investing in the tools to do it. Annoyingly, there's a lot of frames on the market now that might have internal cable routing and that you actually have to take the bottom bracket out to access the cable routing. So if you've got one of those bikes and you're keen on doing your own cable replacements and you have to take the bottom bracket out to do it, then it's probably worth the investment. Whatever bottom bracket tools are required to buy, then it's probably worth doing it at that point.
Yeah, exactly. If you need to run the cables. Yeah. Because it is, going to the bike shop just for a BB, it starts adding up. And if it's something, you shouldn't have to do it that often. But for example, the Creekendale happens quite regularly, and it's a case of just popping it out. I can see they've re-greased it, reseated it, and then it's good for a couple more months until it shifts a little bit. T47 little. I find with the T47, I get a bit of, I think, I don't know if it's dust riding in gravel, the T47's on my gravel bike, and you get, it's a bit of a rub more than a creak, if that makes sense. So I'm not sure if that's sort of dust getting in somewhere under the dust cap. And if just taking the cranks off, giving it a clean would be enough, I imagine.
Yeah. It could be a spacing issue as well. Like maybe not enough preload on the crank spindle. The latest cranks, like the latest dub cranks from SRAM, can be quite fussy over how the number of spaces that you run on the spindle. So they're actually surprisingly, when they go together correctly, they're very easy, but some frames get a little advanced, should I say, where you're playing with a certain number of shims and trying to really achieve the right tension on those bearings without over tensioning them can be a bit of an art.
it would almost be a case of rather go to your bike shop the first time, learn about it. If you're that adamant on doing it yourself, so at least you know what the baseline is for setting it up the correct way. And headsets, is that the sort of, you shouldn't really have reasons to be taking those in and out too often, should you? So, I mean, once they're in theory?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's, if anyone's got like a mass production big name bike, then they probably don't need tools to do the headset. Most of those are just using like a drop-in fit where the bearing will actually pull out by hand and you can go in and, you know, if you can and get access to the fork and you can pull the fork out and inspect the fork steerer, it's always good to do. And then you can actually grease those bearings without any special tools, which is quite cool. If you've got a more advanced, like a titanium bike that's using like a pressed-in headset, then realistically, you shouldn't need to be taking that headset out anytime soon, especially if you get a quality headset. You should be able to, again, like service those bearings with the headset in the bike. So headset tools.
As in just take off, as in re-grease the bearings with it in the headset.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, without having to really go too crazy on the tools. A lot of the headset tools like presses and headset cup removers, they're really designed around like new frame builds and like properly replacing an entire headset, which is pretty advanced. And it might be worth it if you're the type that's building yourself up a new frame every 6 months. But for most people, that's kind of a, you know, you have it done once and it's set and forget for the life of the bike. So it's probably not the category of tool I'd be spending my money on first.
Okay. You made that comment there about the steerer, and we I'm sure a lot of listeners will remember there's been some steerer issues in the past with bikes. Is that something, like, keeping in mind gravel bikes and some of the terrain we ride over, is that something that you should inspect at a certain interval, just pulling the fork out if you're comfortable with it and looking for weakness in the steerer tube because of the impact and force that's going through that area?
Yeah, more so than road bikes, just because you've got that grit. You've got the you've got the grit. You're more likely to have some creek crossings that are putting water in there. You're more likely to wear out the bearings in there, which would then prematurely cause, like, once those bearings are worn, then they're more likely to allow a bit of play in the system. And then it's that play that sort of causes wear on that steerer. So the thing to look for is basically the top bearing of your headset has a compression ring. It's like a little split ring. And that, when the headset's run loose, that will actually rock back and forth and sort of groove into the steerer. So you can kind of, if you take the fork out and you can kind of line it up where the fork steerer sits in line with the top bearing. And if you've got any like indentation in the fork steerer there, then you've probably got a problem.
Okay. So I'm kind of just pivoting this a little bit because it's kind of forming in my mind as we're talking here. So if these guys that are self-servicing, myself included, their bikes, what would you say are the things that you're checking? Okay, headset, we're fine. We're not taking the BB out, but we can take the cranks off. What would be on a deeper level, like, for example, taking cassettes off, checking your steerer tube? What are things that at least once a year, if you're happy to do it yourself, you should be checking on a gravel bike?
Yeah. If you've got cable shifting, I'd probably be replacing the cables, the inner cables. They will fray eventually, regardless of the system. Some brands tend to fray cables more frequently than others, but all will eventually fray a cable. I'd be looking to replace the cables. I'd be looking once a year even to like bleed your hydraulic disc brakes because the fluid will degrade. More so if you've got like SRAM, because they use an automotive brake fluid, which is hydroscopic, so it absorbs water. So it'll actually, you'll end up with more fluid in your brake than the brake's designed for over time, which is quite crazy to think, but it does happen. I'd be looking to like flush out the brake fluid and do a full bleed. Like checking bearings, just giving them a spin, make sure they're turning nicely, turning smoothly, not notchy, not making any real noise. And that goes for the bearings in your hubs, the bearings in your crank, the bottom bracket, and the headset bearings.
Okay. Yeah, because I guess like I had to redo that's why I did my jockey wheels, went through a few river crossings in the UK and just started feeling some funny noises. And so, redid the rear hub and the jockey wheels, and it was a bit strange because I did the jockey wheels and it almost felt a bit stiffer with all the new grease in.
Yeah. Yeah,
but well, then, but when riding, you could definitely feel the difference.
Yeah, it'll help you shifting. But yeah, I mean, anything that moves is going to wear. So that means anything that moves on the bike is going to need attention at some point. I'd also say things like, you know, we're talking about tools for bottom brackets. I'd actually say a tool that might be more useful and more frequently needed than a bottom bracket tool is actually like a derailleur hanger straightener, which is traditionally thought to be like a really workshop specific, you know, a tool that you go to the bike shop for. But derailleurs get bent pretty readily these days, and more so than ever, because we've all got 10, 11, 12, 13, if you're really fancy, 13 speed shifting. It's increasingly more sensitive to being straight. So back when we all had 9 speed shifting, you could kind of kick your derailleur and it'd still work just fine.
Whereas, you just had more tolerance, didn't you?
Yeah, exactly. Whereas now, like, you with the latest 12 speed system, if your derailleur's the slightest bit off, like even to the point that you can't see it, but it's off enough that a tool can tell you, that's going to make a huge difference on the shift quality. So like something like SRAM Eagle, for example, like, I'm sure there's quite a few people that have that, like an Eagle drivetrain on their gravel bike these days, that's hypersensitive to derailleur hanger straightness. So the first thing I ever do when I adjust someone's SRAM Eagle drivetrain is I check the hanger straightness.
Pretty straightforward tool to use, or?
Relatively, yeah. It's basically just checking the squareness of the derailleur hanger off the rim. So, yeah, I mean, there's plenty of YouTube videos of how to use it. And these days you can get them for, you can find them from like starting from $50, and even the cheap ones will do the job good enough.
Okay. And then what about actual adjustment after you've discovered there's an issue?
Yeah. So the tools, if you're confident, the tools will let you get a little bendy to straighten them out. But there's limits to that, and it kind of takes experience to know how much is too much when you're bending a derailleur hanger straight.
Yeah, because there's a lot of sensitive areas there that you could do some untold damage, mm-hmm. I'm sure, if you get it wrong.
Yeah, correct. But yeah, like they're generally soft enough. Like if they're soft enough to have bent out of shape, then they're probably soft enough to bend back a little bit. If it's really bent, then I'd probably be looking to replace the hanger itself. And that's probably just good practice, because yeah, if you've bent it bad enough, then it's probably weakened beyond where it should be being used.
Cool. Okay. Well, there's one. The next topic I wanted to touch on, because you've written a tome on the subject, and no, this is not chain waxes. This is the volume 2, torque wrenches, which was a fascinating read, and something that torque wrenches used to intimidate me, because I'm like, okay, how to use them properly. I now torque all the bolts. I have 2 torque wrenches. I consider myself a little more educated now. What would be your advice, a starting point? You know, the range of torque you should be looking at. What's kind of a summary, if at all possible?
Yeah. Generally, you're more likely to going to cause issues on smaller bolts by over torquing or under torquing smaller bolts than you are on larger bolts. The larger bolts, the tolerance window is much greater for what feels right and what actually is right. So like a crank bolt, for example, if you tighten it until it stops moving, you're probably not going to damage anything and it's probably going to hold tight. Whereas like a stem bolt, if you tighten it till it stops moving, you're going to crack your handlebar and cause all sorts of damage. So a small torque wrench, which does like a low torque range, is going to be sort of the point where I'd recommend you invest first. So roughly speaking, something that covers approximately like a 3 to 15 newton meter range would be enough to do like 90-95% of repairs on a bike, and that would have you covered for everything where you probably should be using a torque wrench. Like anything semi-delicate, that torque wrench will cover it.
And I'm guessing price equals quality when it comes to torque wrench?
To an extent, yeah, you can actually get some really good stuff at the, like, I'd say the second tier up from. So you've got the rubbish, which is if you jump on wish.com or AliExpress or Amazon and you buy the cheapest one there, then you're asking for problems, because some of those are about as accurate as waiting for the crack in your wrist.
Right.
And then, yeah, but the next price point up, you tend to get some pretty good stuff. And like you mentioned Chain Reaction Cycles before. They're, I think their house brand's Lifeline from memory. So Lifeline, they have two torque wrenches. They have their cheap one, and then there's like a pro version. And the pro version's only maybe 20 quid more or something, but it's actually a very good torque wrench, and it's internally it's much the same as to what like Park Tool and Pedro's and Pro and all those brands are selling. Pretty much the same manufacturer. So yeah, you don't have to spend a huge amount, but yeah, roughly that $80 to $100 US mark will get you something that'll last you a long time.
Yeah, I got the Pro. I think it's like the 3 to 15 or 3 to 12. Yeah. And yep. it seems to do the job quite well.
Yeah, that's the value pick, really. Those are honestly, they're probably like, they really are good enough for a shop to use. They're durable and they're accurate and they do the job. And but beyond that, you're not necessarily gaining more accuracy as you go up in price points. You're more just gaining features like, you know, smoother ratcheting head and easier adjustment.
Yeah,
and
just as luxuries, which, okay.
Little luxuries, yeah, but the actual accuracy is actually pretty good on those pro wrenches and those the other brands around that price point. It's they meet the same international standards as a lot of more expensive tools.
Okay, so I think given a lot of information, shall I say, to listeners to kind of ponder on. Any other tools? And oh, by the way, Dave Rome has articles on the internet to go much deeper on all topics and subjects mentioned today. Please go and find that out. We'll put links in the show notes. Any other tools that kind of the top of your head you'd say, oh, that's a good one to have that people might not think of as a normal tool?
Yeah, little things like that are pretty handy, like a pick set or like just a general like straight poker tool. You can make one out of like an old spoke and a file, and you can just make it into a sharp object. They're super handy for like just removing seals off of bearings or opening up the cable, like opening up the end of cable outing before you run the cable through it, or just picking out dirt from small areas. That's definitely a little one, and it can be free if you've got a broken spoke somewhere. But like, yeah, I use that pretty much every single repair. It's just, yeah, it's the ultimate multi-tool. Vernier calipers or digital calipers is another big one for me. Like I use that all the time.
Whereabouts, like what? Yeah, where we're using that?
You can use it for nerdy things. Like you can use it to measure your actual tire width, and then that way you can run your tires through a tire calculator and find out that you've been running 10 psi too much.
And then tell your mates like your Pirelli is not as wide as you think it is and things like that.
Exactly. On the club ride. Exactly. Nice. Yeah. So you can really take like you can be that annoying person in the group.
There's always one. But okay.
You need a digital caliper to do that. you can actually use it to like keep track of chain wear. You can, use it if you are getting more detailed into your bike and you say you're doing a hub repair, you'd use it to measure up the hub bearings to know which bearings to replace. Or your headset bearings, because chances are if you are rebuilding your own headset, it's because something started making noise and now you've opened up your headset and the numbers that were once on it have rusted away, so you need to measure it.
Probably should have looked at the headset a little bit earlier.
For me, like digital calipers, I just find myself using them almost every repair. Like you use them for keeping track of brake pad wear, rotor wear. There's just countless things to use them on. And for me, it's like as soon as you start getting more detailed in your repairs and you start to actually pulling things apart and fixing things, they're pretty instrumental to being able to do that. Little favorite one, little flush cutter for your zip ties, if you've got any zip ties.
Yeah, my kit came with one of those, and I've used that more than I more than I thought I would, especially when I pack my bike up and down in the box with zip ties, etc. Just having that has been a handy little tool.
Yeah. So zip ties, like a poorly cut zip tie will leave a little sharp edge on it, and that's incredibly dangerous. I've seen Got pretty bad visuals of people like gushing blood from having cut themselves on one. So
it's a little knife, effectively, when it's if it's shot.
It is, and yeah, it'll amazingly cuts through flesh when you're least expecting it. So yeah, the flush cutter basically just removes that edge, makes it a really flush cut. So you can use like nail clippers to achieve the same thing, but a pair of plastic model flush cutters only cost like $5 and is a perfect tool. So yeah, I mean there's countless some tools that people probably don't think about that I am a huge fan of. There's a thing called a pliers wrench, which is what the name suggests. So it's a pair of pliers that works as a wrench. So it's kind of...
That's kind of like tightening bolts with a Leatherman, isn't it?
Almost, but this thing actually works really well. So it's kind of like the modern adjustable wrench. And the idea is because it's a plier, you actually can clamp down onto... so it's parallel drawers in a set of pliers. So if you're using it as a spanner, it actually clamps down onto the object. So there's no play between the nut. So you can
get more leverage.
You can get more leverage and you can hold on to whatever you're trying to tighter than what a regular spanner will. So there's applications where that's really good and it can basically, in some cases, replace an entire set of spanners. But for me, it's more the fact that it's just... It's got smooth jaws and they're parallel clamping, so they don't damage anything. They're non-marring. So I'll use it to like help with like pulling cables through. You can use it to crimp cables. If you're doing a mountain bike suspension service, you can actually use it to press bearings into your frame. You can use it to straighten brake rotors. So yeah, for me, it's like the ultimate multi-tool. And I guess like speaking to how useful it is, it's probably the only tool that you'll find in common amongst like every single mechanic at a mountain bike World Cup. It's the one tool they can all agree on is the one to have. So
just because it does so much.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, if you go to a World Cup of like a cyclocross or a mountain bike, or no one goes to gravel World Cups, but if they had people going there and they had
there's a World Cup.
Yeah, if there was World Champs. Yeah, if they had pro mechanics there, then you'd probably find the pliers wrench in the boxes. So.
Okay, I must look at that one. I've probably seen it, but just not known what it was.
Yeah, it's pretty expensive, but it's one of those things that once you have one, you start to find uses for it, and then it becomes quite an instrumental tool. So,
and we're back to the Leatherman analogy, where like let me find ways I can use this tool on things, but in a much safer way, by the sounds of things.
Yeah, yeah. The problem with the Leatherman is like it actually tends to ruin everything it touches.
It just strips.
yeah, yeah. It'll fix everything, but it'll also break everything at the same time.
Yeah.
So, whereas this is like, yeah, it's a professional quality tool. So like, the first time I ever saw it was with a Fox suspension technician, and he was using it to rebuild like fork dampers, which are incredibly delicate. So yeah, then, and you go to a suspension classes with either Fox or RockShox, and they have these in every single bench. So, you know, they're kind of, they're the secret do-it-all tool.
Interesting. I'll definitely have a look at that afterwards. I'm definitely, as I say, I probably would have seen it, but not even known what I was looking at.
Yeah, you will get sticker shock from it. They're incredibly expensive because they're made by a German company, Knipex. But yeah, the 180 millimeter length version. They have a lot of different lengths of them, but 180 mil is sort of where I recommend, and it's money well spent.
Okay, perfect. That's great. All right. So before we moved on to the next little part, was there anything else? I think that's a good base. As you say, there's lots on the internet. I just kind of wanted to give listeners a rundown if there's things that they maybe aren't thinking about. Like even that's given me a lot to think about now, going, okay, those are tools. Maybe there's areas that I shouldn't be working on, and you know where the limit is in a way that if I'm not building bikes regularly, I don't need to have my BB out all the time. If there's an issue, take it to a shop and go from there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's really personal as well, as like some people just want to tinker and want the experience of pulling that apart, and that's cool. Like, you know, go get the tools that let you do that. But if you're purely doing it from a functional point of view where you just want your bike to work, then yeah, maybe you don't need those tools to, maybe you don't need to be pulling apart your bike the whole way. You can do 95% of it without having to invest so much in them.
That's my problem, is that I want to pull it apart, but I am terrified of not being able to put it back together. Why is that part?
You'd be surprised. If you can get a modern bike apart, you probably, for the most part, you'll be able to get it back together. The one thing I'd warn you against is like pulling out brake hoses.
Yeah, my gravel bike, I have to take the cables go in the shell, so the BB kind of has to come. It's got to come out if you want to run those cables, which mechanic's nightmare, but it looks nice. So there you go.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. But like a bottom bracket, I'd say isn't these days isn't super advanced for repair. It might be for something like if you've got your Cannondale, that is a bit more of an advanced repair because just due to the number of tools required. But yeah, like a T47, you know, if you've got the right socket, it's literally just a thread. It's just a big bolt. So I wouldn't be too scared of it.
Cool. Well, I wanted to just kind of move on to, because I know time's flying, as it tends to do when you're talking tools. Just a couple rapid-fire questions to kind of things I would... So top three things, you get a new gravel bike, what would be the top three changes, not necessarily expensive ones, that you would recommend to make it more comfortable? You guys have spoken about a few things over the last little while, but do you have any personal favorites?
Yeah, tires would be first, second, and third thing to look at. Tubeless for me is pretty much a must for gravel, just because you want low pressures with low volume, or relative low volume, and inner tubes are always going to be a limiting factor of how low pressure you can go with that. So for me, tubeless is a huge deal, and is mandatory for me. So that's something that, you know, when I get a test bike in, I'll actually tubeless it before I ride it, because I don't use inner tubes off road. And then from there, like on my own personal gravel bike, I've got I'm using inserts actually. So
are they good? Because I've heard so many amazing things, and then I've also heard people go, oh, it'll destroy your wheels. I'm like, okay, what's
good and bad? It won't destroy your wheels. The good and bad of it is that the good is that I can dump 5 PSI easily from where I would normally strike my rim to then where I don't no longer feel the rim. So I'd go from like around here in Sydney, we typically ride pretty rough gravel roads, which you'd typically more see mountain bikers on. So 35, 36 is typically with normal tubeless setup is the lowest I can go, and I'll still occasionally feel the rim strike. With inserts, I'm at like 30 or even less, with zero fears, and I'm actually riding faster and caring less about what I hit. The problem is the downside with inserts is the weight's a bit of a downside, but not such a big issue. The big issue for me is that it just makes your installation of the tire and removal of the tire just infinitely harder. The installation's not too bad when you're in a workshop, but over time, if you leave that tire on for 3 months and the sealant has stuck the tire to your tubeless rim, and then you've got your insert working against you when you're trying to push that in, and it is hard. So for me, it's like I'm going to great lengths that I've got inserts in my wheels. I'm going to great lengths to ensure that I never have to take that tire off while I'm on the trail. So I've got multiple tubeless plugs. I'm always making sure my sealant is in good condition. And then fingers crossed I don't tear the sidewall. But yeah.
So it's a maintenance thing. Like it has its benefits, but you have to just stay on top of the maintenance of it to appreciate the benefits of it.
You really do. Yeah, you really do. But the benefit is that you basically are able to maximize the volume of the tire, and you're able to really get a lower pressure, which greatly increases your ride comfort without that risk of pinch flatting the actual tire, which, when you start to go really low on pressure and you're on tubeless, you can, I don't know if you've done it, but you can actually pinch the tire itself against the rim bed. And then that's pretty annoying to fix.
I'm not the bravest when it comes to low pressure. I need to experiment more with that. And it's still getting my head around the lower pressure, how much more comfortable it is in the different conditions. I mean, I've read so much, I understand the benefit of it, and the data is there to prove it. It's kind of just, I mean, I ride probably 35 on my 48s on my gravel. But it's so much on between gravel and road here, so I try and find that balance. But I should get more comfortable with letting air out and pumping it back up and doing things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. 35 on 48s is actually, like, in my mind, that seems pretty high. So
that's what it does feel quite high.
Yeah. So there is a tipping point. Like, eventually, once you go low enough with pressure, you will feel the tires start to squirm on road. And there are some people that are used to it and think it's great. I personally prefer my bike to track the way I expect it to when it's on the road. So I don't go super low on pressure, but, like, Jeff Kabush, who's ex-Mountain Bike World Cup racer and cyclocross racer, and he's now sort of a gravel hitter, he's running like 22 PSI in his 40s, and that's using like a tire insert. That's an extreme case, but, you know, he's had a career of racing on tubular cyclocross tires where they're used to riding on the sidewall. But yeah,
so is that why is he doing that? Is that for grip, for feel? It's just a feel he's used to.
Yeah, I mean, it's a feeling he's used to, but it's a performance thing. So your tire is, your bike's basically staying grounded through all the rough stuff. It's not skipping over the top, so it's lower rolling resistance, but also cornering grip would just be immense because your tire is actually conforming to the surface perfectly. So yeah, the grip, when you go that low, the grip is pretty incredible, just because you've always got knob on the ground. And it's not being bounced off, and it's really staying glued to the surface. But yeah, the struggle is when you're that low, going that low, then you start to run into other issues like hitting your rims and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, no, I should definitely give it a go. I mean, the 48s is plenty of tire, so I've got the room to try it out and feel, because it might be quite obvious once you go down to that level. So what was that? It was tires, tubeless, third last item.
I am probably weighing up between seat post comfort and handlebar comfort. The one on top of my mind is these days is like a lot of bikes and a lot of people are looking to their seat post to gain comfort, seated comfort. So you buy any brand new gravel bike and it's probably got a seat post that has some level of flex in it. But the one that's being ignored is handlebar comfort. It's quite remarkable how much of a difference you can get in between different handlebars. So I've just recently built up a new gravel bike for myself, and just to have a play with handlebar shape and all that, I started with the entry-level Easton handlebar, an EA50. It's a really good shape, but the handlebar was actually causing my hands to go numb because it's just like straight gauge alloy tubing. And I could feel, it was super rigid, and I could just feel like the ground stinging my hands. And I guess through experience, I knew that could be changed. So yeah, I've gone with like a Roval carbon handlebar, which is pretty expensive. And perhaps not the sort of handlebar I'd pick if I'm going super rural or, you know, really out back where I might not have access to anyone for a week or two, but
with a carbon shop. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. For my kind of riding, like that's not such an issue. And, it's just night and day over the comfort you get between that and a cheap alloy handlebar. So yeah, I'd say like look for a handlebar with an element of flex to it.
Yeah. I did hear your discussion on that last week, and I had something I hadn't actually thought about going, yeah. And it makes so much sense. As you say, it's that your hands are on the bar, should be on the bar, most of the time. So it really is it makes a lot of sense to add some comfort there where at all possible.
Yeah. And I'd say like there's inevitably going to be people listening to this and thinking, well, I can run a bigger tire and gain comfort there, or I can run thicker bar tape and gain comfort there. But it's actually different. It's a different resonance that you're trying to isolate. And the best example I can give is that a big enduro mountain bike. So you've got 170 millimeters of suspension travel in the front. You've probably got a 2.4 or 2.5 inch wide tire, really low pressure. You've got these big squishy rubber grips in your hands, and yet there's still, you can still feel a difference between different handlebars. And it's just, there's, yeah, your tire picks up a certain frequency, the suspension fork will pick up certain impacts, but the handlebar is really picking up that high frequency noise.
Because that movement is sort of the rigidity that would go through your hands, wrists, arms, whereas like the squishy, cool, that might not hurt your actual fleshy hands, but that handlebar, it's the frequency almost up to your shoulders, if that makes sense, hands through two shoulders.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and that travels through to your neck, your back. So it's, yeah, it, the more of those frequencies you can quieten, you can mute out, the more comfortable you'll be. So it's a combination of things. Like suddenly run a big tire at a low pressure, that'll get rid of certain impacts, and then your bar tape will add a different kind of comfort. But the handlebar as well is a way to overcome the stiffness that a lot of modern bikes have through their front end. Like, you know, a lot of modern gravel bikes have a really stiff fork because that's strong. And as a result, they've got, you know, really stiff, like a bearing junction that doesn't offer a lot of flex. It does allow for a stiff fork. Typically, the stem's not going to be a very flexible item. So, yeah, it comes to the handlebar, and the handlebar is one that you can relatively easily change.
And especially in the gravel bike world, it's not all about weight. So you have room to make things more comfortable.
You do, yeah. Yeah, it's such a tricky one. It's such a nuanced topic, though, and it's something I hope to dive into a bit more. I've got some guests lined up, but it's a hard one because it seems like the most comfortable handlebars these on the market today are actually lightweight carbon bars, where the layup has been tuned to provide that flex, whereas your really durable, dependable, heavy aluminium handlebar is probably also going to be quite stiff. So it's a tricky one, and I'm not really seeing a huge number of brands do well, like overbuilt carbon handlebars with a focus on comfort. Lauf, they have their smoothie handlebar, which is probably on the right track.
But so are you saying that the handlebar overbuilt as in it'll be thicker carbon, or it would need to be thinner to have more flex?
Well, I'd say generally you're seeing most brands offering a carbon handlebar are doing it to hit a weight number. And so, yeah, you're not really seeing too many strong, like really dependably strong carbon handlebars that ignore weight, that just go after strength and comfort. You're seeing a lot of handlebars that go after weight and comfort.
Because I guess it's an easy win for them, because weight for the consumer is a big thing. And as we've just discussed, maybe they're not thinking about the handlebars. So, oh, look at our nice, beautiful, like Canyon seat post. And we can then rather give you a cheaper, lighter carbon way.
It's a market perception issue at the moment, and it kind of goes back to our chat earlier about marketing. But it's at the moment, the customer buying carbon components is probably buying carbon components to achieve weight savings. So a brand would have to really go against the stream, like, you know, go against the stream of the river to produce a $400 carbon handlebar that's actually heavier than, you know, or as heavy as an aluminium handlebar. They're probably not going to be able to sell it, and it'll take a special brand to be able to put forward the message that they've gone all in on comfort and strength without, you know, and that those things matter more than weight, but you still need to pay for that. It's a hard sell.
Yeah, I imagine it would have to be one of the bigger boys with that has clout, because a little guy coming in, it's just going to be like, well, it doesn't make sense. But all right. Well, I mean, I'm looking forward to your future episodes then, for you guys to do a bit of a deep dive on that, because I think for me, and I think for a lot of the listeners, those are the little things which, like, the reason I got into gravel bike riding as well is comfort equals speed, right? It's sort of, you just want to be on your bike a long time. So if you can do those little things that we may not think about, it makes a huge difference, especially in a variety of terrain that we ride on.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, it also keeps me excited, because it's like, you know, I'm looking at that as like a, not a next frontier, but certainly an area that has room to improve. So, you know, it's cool to think that our bikes will keep progressing for the better.
Well, that's the question, isn't it? Because there's certain parts you're like, oh, where does it go to from here? But then you just dive deeper, and then, but all those, I'm going to say it, marginal gains add up to what is a more comfortable ride, which is the, you know, the outcome.
Yeah. 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 And the big one, like, associated with that topic of handlebars is the marginal gain is, you know, a lot of brands for the last 10 years have been speaking about lighter and stiffer. And I really hope they just start talking about more comfortable, like, you know, forget the stiffness, because the stiffness isn't really going to make a huge difference to your ride. If anything, you'll have a better ride with less stiffness. And I think that's the next cool, exciting area.
Well, I mean, as you say, brands always looking for something to market. So by virtue of that cycle, I'm sure something will pop up in that regard anyway. marketers will no doubt be listening to the Gravel Junction right now. So for you guys listening, you're welcome for that insight. One last question, and this is a purely personal one. Is Kaylee Fritz as dangerous to a bike as he alludes to? Would you let him work on your bike?
The hammer himself. I wouldn't let him work on my own bike.
Okay.
But he would be qualified to work in quite a few bike shops.
That's equally terrifying, if I'm quite honest. That doesn't make me feel any better.
He's not as incompetent as he leads on. His brand is to be the dumb one, but
be the hammer.
The thing to remember with Kaylee Fritz, which he never admits to, is he was actually the tech editor of Velo News for quite a few years. So he understands bikes well enough.
I think it's a ploy so that other people can fix his bikes. That's what I feel. Like, if he acts that way, someone else will do it.
Yeah. And he's not afraid to pay a mechanic to do the work. It's more my understanding with him is it's more a care factor. I don't think he actually really enjoys the working on bikes, whereas I do. So for him, it's like, you know, he rides the things more than I do. And for him, the joy comes from riding them. So spending a day pulling it apart and rebuilding it is time away from using it. So,
but it's okay. You wouldn't let him work on your bike. So that, I think that says it. That says everything.
Yeah, it's true. So, but no, he's, he's capable of assembling a bike. So we'll put it there.
We'll leave it at that. Put a line under it there. So that's something, you know, these are things I fall asleep to, you know, listening to his voice, thinking, can he build a bicycle? So, all right, mate. Well, I think we've covered a lot of topics and ended on an awkward note, which is what I aim for.
Great.
Thank you. Thanks so much for the time. I mean, was there anything else? What's the best way? Like, we've purposely not delved into recent political things because there's no need to, and I think everyone listening knows what's going on. But moving forward,
we've kept outside of the topic.
What? Very nice. But for people wanting to hear more from you, whether it be written word, voice, what's kind of the way forward at the moment, or is that still things you're figuring out?
Work in progress. We have a podcast that keeps changing its name. I think it's called the Placeholder Podcast or the Redundant Placeholder. It's something like that. So
first episode of which 9 minutes were 9 minutes you'll never get back, which were amazing.
Thank you. That's what we're going for. The episodes since are probably a little bit more useful. They're more leaning so far toward the road world, the performance road world, world tour, and that kind of chat. There's been a few tangents that are, I think, are more widely applicable to the cycling world, but the goal is to expand that. So I've been asked to create a tech podcast, which should be fun, and that's where I'll talk about handlebar flex and other things like that for the three people that care. Otherwise my personal Instagram is sort of where I'll keep people up to date of what's happening next. My writing will make a comeback in the new year, to be determined where, but my personal Instagram, Rome and stuff, is sort of where I share my musings. Yeah.
I'll make sure to put that in the show notes. Your musings and I have visions sometimes of, I've had a vision of you sort of coming home from the store with a new tool and walking into the living room, and there's close family and friends and a seat in the middle of the room. So Dave, please have a seat. We need to have a conversation.
And this has happened.
About this tool affliction.
Yeah, intervention happened.
You just bought more tools to make yourself feel better.
I did, yeah. Retail therapy got me through it. So, it is unhealthy, but others hopefully benefit from it. So that's how I justify it.
That is the thing, you know. I think that's how heroes are made. The sacrifice that you put before us is most welcomed, and I think we all look forward to seeing what comes in the future. So, I think on that note, thank you for the time, Dave, and I really appreciate chatting with us. We'll hopefully talk soon.
Absolutely. Thanks, Joel.
And there we have it. Another show down. Thanks to Dave for joining us, taking the time out, to have a conversation with us. I know he's been struggling with a really bad cold the last couple of weeks, so I do appreciate him coming on and soldiering on. I think hopefully, well, I know I appreciate it. I got some good info and information, and hopefully you did too. Quick favor, while you're sitting here listening to me, to us, I have no doubt that your device is really nearby. If you could do us the biggest favor, reach over, open the app wherever you're listening to your podcast right now. Drop us a little rating. It doesn't even have to be a review. Hit the little 5-star button there. It goes so far in helping this podcast get discovered by other people, which means a lot. I would really appreciate that. If you had any comments or feedback, as always, head over to thegraveljunctionpodcast.com. That's www.thegraveljunctionpodcast.com. At the bottom of each episode is a comment section. Drop us some comments. Drop us some feedback. What did you like? What didn't you like? What would you like to talk about? Anything. Give us whatever you like. We love it. Other than that, you know, it's coming to the end of the year. Christmas in a few days. I wish you all a wonderful festive season, wherever you may be in the world. And spending wonderful time with friends and family. Thank you for the support this year. It's been a bit of a fun ride, bit of a crazy ride, unexpected, but thoroughly enjoyed it, and hope you have enjoyed what we've brought you. We look forward to bringing you more in 2023. All right. As always, thank you for your time. You keep riding, especially during the festive season. We'll talk soon. Bye for now.